Hi, I'm Phil Johnson, the Executive Director of Grace to You, and I'm here today with James White, who is Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries. And James will be familiar to many of our listeners because he is not only a world-class apologist, but also a best-selling author. A few of my favorite books, James, you've written. Welcome.
It's good to be with you.
In fact, you are the author of The Forgotten Trinity, which is the book I always recommend to people who ask me for a simple but reliable book on the Trinity and all the difficulties of that doctrine. Your book on justification, The God Who Justifies, is, I think, the best simple, thorough outline of the biblical doctrine of justification that's in print today, and I'm so glad you wrote that book.
I like to try to address those issues that really define the faith and help people to be passionate about the central defining doctrines of the faith, not just something that's believed out there, but something that impacts your life every day. We are Trinitarian Christians. We should view life in the light of the God that we worship. And so I love getting a chance to explain those things to people.
And you've written books about issues that other people are passionate about that maybe they shouldn't. I'm thinking now of the King James Only controversy, which is maybe your best known book.
It is, and continues to amaze me where that book has gone. But I'm very thankful that book has been used as a textbook to help introduce many pastors to being able to explain to their people where the Bible came from. Why are those little notes at the bottom of the page and say, some manuscripts say this, some manuscripts say that? And so it's definitely indicative of the fact that I'm getting older, that was written. I wrote that in 1994, and it came out in 1995.
Has it been that long?
It has
been that
long.
That's an extremely helpful book, because that's an issue we all deal with. And until I read your book, I just always thought it was kind of over my head and would always defer the inquiry to someone else. But now I generally recommend your book.
Well, good. That's exactly what I tried to do with it, is because we can't – there was a time when we could do that, Phil, but we live in a society now where attacks upon the veracity of the Scriptures are so prevalent. I mean, you now see them in the grocery store checkout lane. Scholars say this, scholars say that I don't think it's any longer an option for a Christian to be ignorant about where the Bible came from and why we can trust it.
And just before we started recording, James, you were telling me that your second best-selling book is one I've never even heard of.
And probably never even seen.
Called Grieving, Our Path to Peace. And no, I never have seen it. Yeah. Tell us about that book.
Well, for a number of years, I was a hospital chaplain. And to be honest with you, I started that work because the ministry couldn't support me and my family in doing apologetics. And hospital chaplaincy was one of the most difficult things I ever did. I had never seen anyone pass away. I had never been in the death room before. And I had to do a loss support group every week. And meeting, this was not a Christian hospital, so meeting with unbelievers who had experienced loss and trying to discuss issues of hope with them was life-changing, extremely difficult. And an acquaintance of mine lost his 29-day-old granddaughter a few years after I had left the chaplaincy. And I cleared my desk after the funeral, and I spent 4 days. And I wrote this all for him initially. And then when I saw that this would be something a lot of people might benefit from, I submitted it to a friend of mine who was an editor like you are, and he loved it. But he took my name off of it before he brought it into the publishing house, because no one would believe that someone had written the books that I wrote. I could have actually written a book on grieving, but I was very heartened to know that they were distributing that book to the rescue workers on September 12th and 13th and 14th there in New York City in 2001. So it has had quite a distribution.
Yeah, that's great. That is really great. Well, tell us just briefly how you got into apologetics. You started dealing with Mormonism, right?
Oh, yes, most definitely. I was raised in a Christian family. In fact, as far back as we can trace on my father's side, all the way back to Scotland, we've been ministers. And so I was given a very strong biblical background. My father's a graduate of Moody Bible Institute. And so I remember as about an 8 or 9 year old boy, my mother took me to her work, which was at a secular printing plant. And I remember arguing with the pressman over the Christian faith at 8 or 9 years of age and things like that. So that's sort of been a part of my genetic makeup all along.
Not just arguing, but you told me once that when you were in fourth grade, you yes. were passing out tracts.
I was passing out tracts on the playground.
Evangelism and, as well.
That's right. That's right. And I was sent to the principal's office for that, and so I gave the principal a tract too. And so, yeah, that was just sort of my makeup. But the apologetic aspect, I didn't know what an apologist was in Bible college. If you had told me when I was in college that this is what I was going to be doing, I wouldn't have had any way of understanding that whole concept. But what happened was two more missionaries came by my sister-in-law's home shortly after I was married. I was married very young. I was 19. She was 18. We just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary. And I started meeting with these missionaries. And I was greatly challenged. Not that they were presenting things to me that I couldn't respond to, but I was greatly challenged that I didn't know enough about what they believed to coherently express my faith to them. And that began a lengthy study of Mormonism, and we began missions work up in Salt Lake City, out in Mesa, Arizona. For many years, we would go up there and do that. And that then led to people asking me questions about Jehovah's Witnesses, so I expanded into that area. And that really was the genesis almost right at 25 years ago now of Alpha and Omega Ministries.
In fact, some of your oldest books have to do with Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses.
Well, especially Letters to a Mormon Elder is a book that has had a long life because it speaks so directly to the Mormon person, and yet it functions as a training manual for Christians on how they can present biblical truth to the LDS people. And sadly, there's so much confusion today about Mormonism and what Mormonism actually teaches that book has come back into print again, just simply to try to help people with that particular subject.
And in a way, I suppose your book on the Trinity in particular came out of your work with both Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses.
You really have to be able to give a fully biblical apologetic of the doctrine of the Trinity, because after you deal with Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses, there's really only one more major group, the Oneness Pentecostals, to deal with, and you now cover the major Trinitarian heresies. And I had learned along the way that Christians respond to the Word of God. I can sit there and talk about the Council of Nicaea till I'm blue in the faith, and there's going to be some people who might find something useful in that. But your average church-going, believing Christian responds to presentations that are based on and draw their life from the Word of God. And I recognized that there was almost nothing in print on the doctrine of the Trinity that was not absolutely stultifyingly boring. And I've always said that teaching theology in such a way as to bore people is a sin. If you're not passionate about what you're teaching, I think you should probably find another field to work in. And so the Forgotten Trinity is a biblical presentation of the doctrine of the Trinity. It takes its lifeblood from the text rather than from some, you know, historical survey. Certainly it's important to know about the Council of Nicaea and things like that. But the reason I believe in the doctrine of the Trinity is because the Word of God forces me to believe in the doctrine of the Trinity. It's a revealed doctrine. And that's why I began the book with a question that really caught a lot of people by surprise. I said, "Do you love the Trinity?" And I asked them, "When was the last time you ever heard anyone say, 'I love the Trinity'?" You hear people say, "I love prophecy and I love all these things, but I love the Trinity." Mm. And why don't Christians say that? Because they don't understand it. And you're not going to proclaim passion for something that in your honest moments you're going to admit, "I really don't understand this. And in fact, if I was really going to be honest, I don't see how this relates to my life at all." And so I wanted Christians, how do you enter into real, true, and deep worship if you're ignorant of the God you're worshiping? And so that was really the impetus behind The Forgotten Trinity.
That explains why that's such a good book. It is a page-turner, and when you tell people, here's this book on the Trinity that I just couldn't put down,
that's pretty
people
unusual.
Are taken by surprise.
Yeah, definitely. And that's been so exciting to me to have people come up to me in faraway places and say, "I love the Trinity." That means I accomplished what I was trying to accomplish there.
Now, I first encountered you, James, more than 15 years ago, probably through the medium that you are best known for. And that is your public debates. You debate some of the brightest minds in some of these cults and other religions that you deal with. And it seems to me that you're willing to take all comers.
In a sense, it is interesting. I sort of have two sets of standards. When it comes to what we might call debates within the very, 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 very broad spectrum of what's called Christianity, at least something that has something to do with Jesus, you know, I try to go for the best the other side has to offer. I really, really do. And there are a lot of people who will challenge me that we don't find to really be worth the investment of putting the time into. But in the debates that I'm now doing with Islamic apologists, I've had to vary that a little bit, because while I've already debated men like Shabir Ali, who is a doctoral student in Islamic studies up in Toronto and an accomplished debater, his arguments do not represent what I would call the Muslim street. That is what you're going to hear if you live in Syria or Lebanon or Iraq or Iran, for that matter. And so I have to be willing to debate some apologists from the Islamic perspective who are not quite as well educated or as polished in their presentations as a Shabir Ali is, but their arguments are more representative of what my brothers and sisters who are persecuted in those lands would be hearing on the Muslim street. And so those, I believe it or not, I don't like arguing. I'm not just an argumentative person and just like getting into fights with people. I really don't. But what I want to do is I want to produce a body of work that is going to be continuing to bless people long after I'm moldering in the grave. And to do that, you need to try to choose your debate opponents in such a fashion as to represent not only the best that Islam has to offer, but also the normative that Islam has to offer. And so I have debates coming up this year with individuals that it's going to be a little bit of a fight, shall we say. There's going to be a lot of accusations coming from one side and things like that. But I think even in that context, the way you respond to that, the way you don't respond to that, the way that you model Christian charity and grace is also a form of testimony as well.
Now, you are turning your attention these days to Islam for obvious reasons. And I want to get to that and ask you quite a bit about Islam. But before we do, just rehearse some of the better debates you've done, because you have debated a number of people on a number of issues. You may be the most prolific debater in the evangelical world.
I might. Certainly the range of things has been quite interesting. I think one of the most interesting debates I had over the past few years was with the co-founder of the Jesus Seminar, Dr. John Dominic Crossan. And many of the people in the audience will recognize that name. He shows up on television almost every Easter and every Christmas. Just this past year, he and Marcus Borg put out a book on the birth narratives. And, of course, they're coming from an extremely – so far out to the left, they're almost to the right in some senses. And what I found very interesting about the debate was Dr. Crossan is unlike almost anyone else I've debated. He is a brilliant man. He truly is. His IQ is off the charts. He is a former Roman Catholic monk. And he spent the entire decade of the 60s in a cell reading the Synoptic Gospels. I mean, that's all he did. And I could tell in debating Dr. Crossan, he had never run into anyone like me before. I guess there are not too many people like me running around in Roman Catholic monasteries. And what I appreciated about him was that when I would respond, he would truly listen. He wasn't just defending his position. He was truly listening. He was trying to interact with what I was saying. And so we debated the historical reliability of the Gospels, and I'm hoping that something's going to develop in doing some more debates in the future. He's been open to doing that. But Dr. Crossan was fascinating. On the other end of the spectrum, I debated John Shelby Spong, the infamous former bishop from Newark, New Jersey, on the subject, is homosexuality compatible with biblical Christianity? And that was just sort of, like I said, the opposite end of the spectrum from my debate with John Dominic Crossan, but very similar to when I debated Barry Lynn, the head of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, on the very same issue. And in fact, what was fascinating to me is that both Bishop Spong and Barry Lynn came to a debate on whether homosexuality is consistent with the Bible without bringing a Bible. Bishop Spong never had one on his desk, and Barry Lynn had to borrow mine at one point to read from Romans 1. So it was quite interesting. But I've also done a lot of debates with Roman Catholic apologists.
And on practically every point of Catholic theology.
Almost. There are still a few we're trying to arrange, but the best debates I've had, interestingly enough, have not been with the convert apologists, like a Jerry Matatix or a Jimmy Akin or something like that. I say the five best debates with Roman Catholic apologists have been with Mitchell Pacwa, who's a lifetime Catholic, Roman Catholic priest. And we've debated justification, the Mass, the papacy, sola scriptura, and the priesthood. And what I liked about those debates is there's nothing personal. There's no ad hominem. He's not trying to dodge what he actually believes. And I think we really modeled how that kind of debate can be done and how it can be done in an appropriate and proper fashion. And so I've also debated really about the only Jehovah's Witness apologist out there, Greg Stafford, on the
Deity of Christ. I remember that.
That's right, in Tampa. And I've also done a series with LDS apologists up in Salt Lake City as well, though we cannot get the leading LDS apologists to do formal debates. Some less leading apologists have, and those are useful as well. So we've addressed a pretty wide variety of subjects over the years.
For more information about the Ministry of Grace to you, visit www.gty.org. That's gty.org. Or call 1-800-55-GRACE.